sports bettors, Circa Sports now presents Palm Saturdays with Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm. Live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Here on 104.3 The Score. And watch live on YouTube and Twitch. Featuring the latest and the greatest of the sports betting landscape from coast to coast, along with some great guests. Here he is, Mike Palm.
Everybody in Chicago and listening beyond, it is such a pleasure to join the Score 104.3 on this historic week as well. We were in Chicago on Sunday and Monday. Derek Stevens, owner of Circa, helped Mitch Rosen flip the switch, going to FM as well. And it's certainly an honor and a pleasure to be joining you every Saturday morning and be able to say the Score is now live at 8 a.m. Central Time on Saturdays. What a great time slot for everybody waking up in the great city of Chicago, and what a great lead in this will be to Inside the Clubhouse with David Haw and Bruce Levine, that very popular show. Hopefully a few of those listeners that are loyal to that show are tuning in early and figure out that now we're live on the Score. This is Palm Saturdays. I am Mike Palm, Vice President of Operations for Circa, the D and the Golden Gate, here in downtown Las Vegas, as well as Circa Sports, which is, of course, in Illinois and presenting this show to you in your neighboring states of Iowa and Missouri and Kentucky and Colorado as well. So certainly happy to be coming to you and be able to share some information and some thoughts and some entertaining conversations, hopefully, with our guests about the sports betting world, the world of sports in general, what's going on in Chicago, what's going on all across the world. Very excited that my very first guest this week will be none other than our Hall of Fame broadcaster, the voice of the Blackhawks, Pat Foley, who's going to join us here in a little over 20 minutes. I had to ask Pat to get up early and do me a favor today. He, of course, is in Lake Tahoe right now, so we really appreciate the time. But should be a great conversation with Pat at 8:25. Well, a little bit about me before we start talking about Super Bowl 60 tomorrow. I was born in Dubuque, Iowa, so naturally my dad was a huge Chicago sports fan, loved the Cubs, the Bears, the Bulls, and the Blackhawks, and of course I grew up following his favorite teams as well. Would get into Chicago to see the Cubs at least three or four times every year. That was a big part of my childhood. Graduated from Wallert High School in Dubuque and went on to the University of Notre Dame, where I was actually in the seminary program for a couple years. Decided I wanted to be a dad. Of course, that came to fruition 24 years later. But went back to Iowa and taught in a Catholic school for a couple years. I was teaching every subject to 7th and 8th graders in Boone, Iowa, except art and music, and coaching every sport. And in the year 1996, making $16,800 a year. And so I decided, how the heck am I going to pay Sally Mae back if I don't get a second job? So my side hustle, I started dealing poker. And let's fast forward 30 years, and we're here in 2026, and I've been in the casino industry and part of the sports betting industry. So it's a pleasure to be here, and as we get to know each other more and more through the coming Saturdays, there'll be more stories along the way. Well, the big news, of course, is the long wait is over, and really it has been a long wait this year for Super Bowl 60. I can't recall a year, and maybe there have been some, but I can't recall a year where there was really less buzz around a football game than this year. And I try to think of the number of factors of why. Is it because it's Coastal's team? Is it because Seattle doesn't have any huge superstars? Is there still New England fatigue? But for whatever reason, there hasn't been a ton of buzz. If ever there was a year not to have 2 weeks in between a game, it might have been this year. But here we are. We've gotten there. And, you know, about a little over 30 hours from the kick tomorrow afternoon from Santa Clara. So from a betting perspective, Circa opened this game 2 weeks ago Sunday when the championship games were over with the Seahawks as a four-point favorite over the Patriots. Some books opened 3.5. The majority opened 4. We were quickly bet up in the 24 hours after we opened the line from 4 to 4.5 to 5 to even touching 5.5 on that Monday, and that's when the buyback started on the Patriots. And by Tuesday morning, we were at 4.5 with minus 110 on each side. For those of you who aren't familiar with the juice in sports betting, that's the standard. You know, when you make a bet, you have to lay 11 to win 10. That's how the books make their money on that juice. So 4.5, 110 on each side. And as we sit here now, almost 2 weeks later, we haven't budged an inch on the point spread. We're still at 4.5 minus 110. Now, in looking at the board and looking at other books, a couple have gone to Seattle favored by 5, and a couple have gone to Seattle with the increased juice, minus 4.5, minus 112. You'd have to lay 112, minus 115. So right now, Circa is the best price of the market if you do like the Seahawks and you want to lay 4.5. In terms of the total, we opened that at 46, and it's slowly crept down, 45.5. We got to 45 this past Monday, and that hasn't moved an inch at all. So we're 45 minus 110 both ways on the total. The money line, we opened 215 plus 188 on the Patriots to win the game outright. We did take $1 million bet on the Patriots last week, $1.1 million to essentially win $2 million. But the windup to that, or the backstory, is that gentleman had come in and placed a lot of Seahawks futures before the season began, and had done pretty nicely with both Circa and MGM, BetMGM. I think he got down a combination of about $70,000 between our two books on the following bets: the Seahawks to make the playoffs at plus 180, the Seahawks to win the NFC West at 6-1. Nice cash there. The Seahawks to win the NFC at 37-1. Blended price maybe 36-1 with MGM. And then the Seahawks to win the Super Bowl at 75-1. In the NFC Championship game, he did hedge $500,000 on the Rams plus 2.5. So he would have had a middle there. I'm sure he wished Sean McVay would have kicked the field goal down 4 with 4 minutes left to go on that 4th-and-2. He could have possibly won both those bets. And now this is a hedge. So essentially, When the game is over tomorrow, if the Seahawks win the game, this gentleman wins $2.6 million. And if the Patriots win the game, he wins $2 million. Not a bad spot to be in. All right, let's talk about overall thoughts on this game. The Super Bowl, you know, used to be unique for many years in that it had this menu of prop bets you could make. When for many years, you couldn't really bet props until you got to the Super Bowl. And then this prop menu kept expanding and expanding and expanding to today. There are some books who offer tens of thousands of props. And every book offers several hundred at least. We have a packet about this thick of all the props. And then there's all the variations of the different prop bets. I will say that it's a more educated consumer today than maybe even 5 years ago, and certainly 10 years ago or more, as props have become a part of everyday betting. And I believe this is due to the fact that so many of the bettors of today who've turned 21 now and can bet legally grew up on daily fantasy sports, where you're more concerned with players' performance than you are teams' performance. I think another factor is the mobility of players who often transition after a few years from team to team, or in the college ranks with the transfer portal and NIL now. It's a completely reconstructed team in almost every sport, not just basketball and football every year. So we have an educated public who's used to betting certain things on props. Almost every NFL game has first touchdown score, anytime touchdown score, how many passing yards over under will the quarterback have, how many touchdowns, how many interceptions, how many rushing yards, how many rushing attempts, how many receiving yards, how many receptions. Some even have how many targets. There's defensive stats, sacks, all of these things. Well, that's this on steroids now for the Super Bowl. So it is a fun way because you have so many different options. To my point about how prevalent props have become in the betting world, I think that in general, both the NHL and the NBA, more money is written on player props than on the team or the total amount of points or pucks in a game. It's really amazing. Our first year in Illinois with Circa Sports, our total handle combined on all the Blackhawks games, on just the Blackhawks or their opponent to win, or the puck line, or the total, was less than props bet on Connor Bedard. It's absolutely shocking, and I probably asked Pat Foley about that when we talked to him in the next segment. So there's many different ways to attack this game. Let's think about how I think about it from an overall perspective and some facts that may color your opinion or lead you to a bet. I'll share with you what bets I've made as well. I always think about, is there an advantage for a team that has played in that stadium before that year? So in this case, the Seahawks play in the NFC West, this game being played at the home of the San Francisco 49ers at Levi Stadium in Santa Clara. So they play there every year. And in fact, this year played there right at the end of the regular season. Remember beating the 49ers 13-3 in that game where they really, 49ers, struggled for every yard they got. So there's been 13 times in Super Bowl history where one of the participants has played in that stadium during that season. Now, two of those were home teams, and they both won. That was the Rams, who defeated the Bengals at SoFi, and that was Tampa Bay when they beat the Chiefs at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa. So let's throw those two out, because that's not the case here. It's the case of having played one game in the stadium. When you throw those two games out, the record is still 9-2, and that's a 9-2 straight-up record, not counting the point spread. That's a very, very strong trend. Now you can say, well, it's not a big sample size. Well, there's been 60 Super Bowls, and that's 11 of them. So, I mean, 1/6 of them, or 18%, have had that result. So think about that trend when you think about the overall winner of this game. Does Seattle have the advantage by having played at Levi Stadium before? Now, I'm going to give you a counter-argument here about prep and about having gone through the experience. The Super Bowl and the whole experience of having come out and do all these media days and open practices and the length of the anthem and the length of the game and the length of the commercials and the halftime show being so elongated, Bad Bunny this year, it's different than any other game that you play in. Now, you could argue that, you know, the championship games, now they sort of have these mini concerts at halftime. I'll never forget what Mike Pritchard told me. And Mike Pritchard, of course, who went to Rancho High School here in Las Vegas, won a national championship with the Colorado Buffaloes, was a top 10 pick in the draft, and played basically a 9-year NFL career for Atlanta, Denver, and Seattle. And I co-hosted a football show with him and Femi Abedefi, who some of the Odyssey audience is familiar with on VSiN a couple years ago on Friday mornings. And I always gave him a hard time because I like Nebraska football, and I always was against Colorado and McCartney and those teams. And, of course, graduating from Notre Dame, I said it was a fictitious national championship for Mike Pritchard because of the phantom clipping call on the Rocket punt return. And he says it was an obvious clipping, and my argument was the year before in the Orange Bowl, Colorado was number one and Notre Dame beat them handily. And his argument was Notre Dame didn't beat us, the halftime beat us. We were used to an 18-minute halftime all season, and the 40-minute halftime, our first time playing in the Orange Bowl, absolutely sapped us. So you have the experience of Mike Vrabel, who's gone through these Super Bowls before, and does that have any advantage for New England in that he can prep them for that? Now, Darnold, of course, played for the 49ers in a backup role in a Super Bowl before, so he does have that experience as well. I want to talk about some conversations I've had with a friend of mine who works in the front office for the Vikings. This is the best source I have in all of sports. Everything he has ever told me through the years has been 100% accurate. And he, of course, was talking to the Vikings coaching staff this week about the Super Bowl, and specifically Brian Flores and the defensive coaching staff, about how they would approach if they were running the defenses for each of these teams. The Viking coaches said if they had Seattle, they would take away everything over the top for Drake May and not let him beat you deep, not let him get a chunk play. So I think about Kayshon Booty props. And force a young quarterback in his second year who has struggled in the playoffs. Certainly his performance has paled in comparison to his regular season where he narrowly missed the MVP by just one first-place vote to Matt Stafford. Make him be patient. Make him check down. Make him go through his progressions. Make New England take 12 and 14 and 16 plays to drive the ball down the field without making mistakes. They said if they had the New England defense, it would be exactly the opposite. They would try to take away everything easy from Sam Darnold and dare him to beat them over the top, which then leads you to some Jackson, Smith, and Jigba props. So what is my overall theory of the game? And we'll recap this before the show ends here at the end of the hour. I believe this will be a low-scoring game. In principle, I have bet this under 45.5, and I advise a bet of under 45 at the current line. There are still 45.5s out there in the market. Seattle is very good defensively, especially in their front four and their secondary. I do believe they will be able to put pressure on Drake May, and unlike Vance Joseph and the Broncos, will spy him and not let him beat them with their legs. So I think New England will struggle to move the football in this game. At the same time, I think New England can look at the defensive game plan that the Vikings actually put together when the Vikings went out to Seattle and played on November 30th in that game. Now, that was the game that Max Brosmer, the undrafted University of Minnesota graduate, played quarterback for the Vikings. He's clearly not ready to be an NFL quarterback. They essentially had no offense and got shut out. So with Seattle having the ball the whole game, Darnold only threw for 120 yards. They sacked him four times. They held JSN, Jackson Smith, Ajigba, the breakout wide receiver for the Seahawks, to just two catches. 3.3 yards per play and one offensive touchdown. 2 weeks to prepare. Coach of the Year Mike Vrabel, I believe, will take a look at that tape. So I think this is going to be a low-scoring game. For the VSiN Football Guide, I wrote up the final as 19-17, meaning four field goals for Seattle, one for New England. Maybe it's 19-16. It's not an advocation of one side or the other on the point spread. But it does lead me to some of these props. Also note a key factor for me that Mike McDonald and Mike Vrabel are not into the Ben Johnson, Sean Payton, Staley, go for it on fourth down every time or take those risks. They take the points a lot when they're outside of the five-yard line and they're facing a fourth down. So what are the props that I have in my pocket? I have over 3.5 field goals being made in the game. I have Jason Myers, the Seattle kicker, over 1.5 field goals minus 180 and over 2.5 field goals plus 170. Jason Myers over 8.5 points at plus 120. Here's one I really love, that the distance of the longest field goal made will be higher than the total points scored in the game. I have that bet at minus 120. And then the two that I gleaned from talking to my source with the Vikings, if they're going to dare Seattle, as they suggest, to beat them over the top, JSN's longest reception over 29.5 yards. And on the other side, if they're going to force, Seattle's going to force Drake May for short throws and to check down. The greatest possession receiver this year in all of football was that psychopath Stephon Diggs. So I bet him over 4.5 receptions. Now, I am a former official myself. Baseball and softball, I worked in the Big Ten, and at the time it was the Big Eight, now the Big 12. I thought at one time I wanted to be a Major League Baseball umpire, but I've officiated basketball, football, volleyball, all those sports. So I usually try to handicap the officials in the game. Sean Smith from the Detroit area is going to be the referee for this game. Now, it's hard to deduce crew tendencies because it's an all-star crew. But Sean Smith generally is in the bottom 15 to 20% every year in penalties called. Glean what you can from that. Interesting career for him. Started out doing Pop Warner, then doing flag football, then high school, went to Division II, worked in Conference USA, the MAC, and then the Big Ten for one season. He was a back judge in the Big Ten for one season and got promoted to the NFL. That's incredible in and of itself. He was hired as an umpire in 2015 and then promoted to referee in 2018 following the retirement of Terry McCauley and Gene Steratore at the same time. Sean Smith is an interesting handicap. I think that if you look at penalty props, I might lean under on that. But congratulations to Sean Smith on his assignment for this game. Hopefully you've gleaned some information out of all of that that I've talked to you about, and you can find some of your own bets. Or if you want to tag along with us, you can as well. And, of course, next Saturday we'll grade where Mike Palm was right and where Mike Palm was wrong. So excited to have my next guest, my very first guest, and a great friend of mine, the legendary voice of the Chicago Blackhawks. Pat Foley will join us on Palm Saturdays. That's coming up right after the break.
Bear working against Tate, who won the puck. It's out. They score. Jonathan Tate. Outworked Ethan Bear and Kubalik. Bang! The Hawks with the lead.
Got it around the board. Chelios.
10-1. They score. Hawks win. Jeremy Roenick tipped it in. Hawks win in overtime.
Kane dropped it to Tate. Got away from Gessler. Cuts it with a shot.
Seabrook, here it comes. If they score, a redirect. 5.5 left. And the Hawks, for the second straight game, have tied it late.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be, with no bet fees, on 104.3 The Score.
That is the voice of the great Pat Foley. Does that bring up some memories for all of us? And joining us right now on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline, it's none other than the voice of the Blackhawks, Pat Foley. Good morning, Pat. How are you?
Mikey, if it's Palm Saturday, do I do the sign of the cross and genuflect before we get going? How do we do this?
You know, they're thinking about shooting some promos here, and we looked at some different vignettes. One of them is me riding into Bar Canada on a donkey with the dancing dealers waving palm branches. I don't know if that's going to be the one we go with. Pat, you're born in Glenview. Clear this up for me. Is Glenview North Shore, or is it too far inland?
No, I think it's considered North Shore. If not Winnetka or Kenilworth or some of the we're the other side of the tracks, I guess. Put it that way.
Pat, when we talked at Circa last year, when we had that great dinner at Barry's Downtown Prime, you said, you know, you missed the 2.5 hours behind the mic, but you didn't really miss the prep and the travel and the grind of 82 games. We're a year removed from that. How many times over the last few months have you missed being in the booth?
Well, really very few, Mike. I mean, what I said to you, I still hold. You know, doing the job and calling the game or attempting to, you know, was really fun. It's a great challenge. It's the fastest sport in the world. And, you know, took a long time for me to get where I got. So I enjoyed those couple of hours sitting in the chair. But really, you know, everything else, and the prep work just became more and more demanding. You know, don't forget, when I started, there were 21 teams in the league. Now there's 32, and there's, you know, they're talking about a couple more coming in. So needing to know who the third line left winger of the Philadelphia Flyers is, you know, doesn't really matter to me anymore. So I don't miss it very much. Being at the games is great. And, you know, it still is the greatest sport in the world. But the job, you know, 40 years was enough. I'll put it that way.
Let me give you a ridiculous hypothetical, but I think it's a fun one. If in January NBC had called you and said, look, Kenny Albert can't do it and this and that, would you be willing to come to Italy for 3 weeks and do the Olympics for us? What would your answer have been?
I'd be sitting next to Eddie Olczyk, so it probably would have been yes. But don't worry about it. NBC never really liked me, and I don't think the league office is a big fan of mine either. So don't worry about that.
Speaking of the league office, you led me right into this, Pat. I listen to so many broadcasts doing what I do and betting and talking about betting, in every sport. I listen to many broadcasts from a lot of local guys, of course, the national guys in football. It's my opinion, and I wonder if you share this, do you think that hockey announcers, compared to the other major sports, have more latitude in being honest and critical about what they're seeing? I searched for a recent clip as an example of this. I think we have it, Adam.
This is the third time in five games that a start time of 8:42 local was mandated. I can say with certainty, players cannot stand these late starts. Coaches cannot stand them. Most importantly, the fans can't stand them. So as we approach midnight Eastern again on a work night, a school night, a simple question. An 8:42 puck drop serves who? We'll be back.
I get chills every time I hear that, Pat. Were you more open? Are hockey announcers more free to be open and honest in the booth?
Well, maybe a little. Listen, I don't know anybody in the business that would have said that. You know, but I mean, look, I said it because I believed it was right. And by the way, an interesting sidebar on that one. The next day, Gary Bettman had a previously scheduled national press conference. You know, all these different media folks are in the room. And, you know, of course, Mr. Bettman is prepared with all his bullet points about, you know, concussions or expansion or, you know, whatever the things were he was ready to talk about. The first question of that press conference was, how come you're starting your game so late?
You moved the national media. I love it, Pat. You know, one of the things you did kind of as the piecemeal after you officially retired was the Winter Classic. And, you know, I loved the Winter Classic and the whole idea at the beginning and playing these outdoor games at Wrigley Field, at Yankee Stadium, at Fenway Park, at Notre Dame Stadium. It was terrific. And the viewership pre-2010, The average number of TV viewers of the Winter Classic was 4.1 million per game. From 2010 to 2019, 3.2 million. And since 2020, 1.1 million. In fact, the two games, the Blackhawks-Blues and the Panthers and Rangers, the two previous games had less than a million viewers. And then we saw last Sunday a really good game in Tampa. But we are now, and they got 2 million viewers, we are now having the Winter Classic in Florida, in Miami, and Tampa, in Dallas. They hit a home run next year because they're going to have it at Rice-Eccles at the University of Utah with Colorado and the Mammoth. But in light of these viewership numbers, is the Winter Classic something that's run its course, Pat?
Oh, I don't think so at all, Mike. I really believe that in the places that host them, it is a huge event, and believe me, I can tell you there are 32 owners that are lobbying the league office to get one of these games on an annual basis. So look, if you're worried about hockey viewership numbers, that's always going to be a constant concern. And by the way, you know, the early numbers you quoted for the Winter Classic, yes, of course it was a new thing. Now it's not so new, and then they add the Stadium Series games. So there's, you know, a couple, three, four of these every year. So that part of it has lost its luster. And also in the early years, remember January 1, hockey owned that for a couple of years because the bowl games went to a different day. You know, all the bowl games were on New Year's Day. Now that's, you know, then that evolved into something else. So hockey did not have a lot of competition on New Year's Day in those particular early years. So all those things played into, you know, more viewership. But, no, the Winter Classic cannot and should not go away. It's a great event for the places that host them. I mean, you know, I did a Stadium Series game a couple of years ago, and they tried to do the Ohio State-Michigan thing, so they had Columbus host Detroit in Ohio State Football Stadium. I mean, it was a great event. There were 95,000 people there. Did it get great viewership? I don't know. I don't remember what the numbers were. I was just doing radio with Eddie on an NHL radio network. So it's a great event. I do not think it should go away. Maybe you're not going to generate the kind of numbers that you did previously, but I say who cares?
Yeah, I think that they may have found their spot here on this Pro Bowl weekend. Nobody cares about the Pro Bowl anymore. The problem is you've got the college football playoff games now competing with it on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, and this Pro Bowl weekend has nothing. So you saw the, having it on that Pro Bowl weekend was great. I just want to let Pat know you're listening to Palm Saturdays here on 104.3 The Score. There's 3 minutes and 33 seconds left in the segment. All right. Pat, you worked 17 seasons with Dale Tallon, 13 with Eddie O. I grew up listening to you and Dale. Explain to me why Dale Tallon does not get enough credit as a slash general manager or talent evaluator. He built the core of five Stanley Cup winning teams, three with the Blackhawks in 10, 13, and 15. Taze, Kane, Duncan Keith, Seabrook, Corey Crawford, Sharp, Hossa, and with the Panthers, Barkov, Ekblad, and got Bobrovsky. Why isn't now, or maybe will history remember how great Dale Tallon was as a front office person?
Well, it's a great question. I do think that most people in hockey certainly know how great a talent evaluator he is. By the way, he's a great guy, and he's fun to be around. And you can't have more fun than traveling around the NHL with Dale Tallon for 17 years. So I've had some real nice perks in the job that I used to do. In the general public, look, at Blackhawks fans, I do believe give credit to Dale Tallon for building the core of those championship teams. By the way, all seven guys that were on all three teams, those were all his acquisitions. The first cup in 2010, every player on that team was a Dale Tallon pickup, either a draft or a trade or free agent signing. So, look it. Hawks fans know what he did. Florida fans know what he did. I give Bill Cito, the current Florida GM, big credit because he singled out Dale and thanked him for the core that he put together in Florida. So, Mike, you're right. I kid Dale a lot. You know, you can build a team. How come you can't hold a job? Can't you get along with anybody? So, he's a great guy, and I think he does get the deserved credit that should be coming to him.
I'm going to take you out with this question. We're on the Olympic break right now. How impactful do you think the Olympics might be to the rest of the NHL regular season? And I ask it in this context. If you go back and look at the 2014 Olympics, that's the last time the NHL players participated before now. John Tavares, playing for Team Canada, out for the season for the Islanders with a torn ACL. Henrik Zetterberg, out for the season with a herniated disc, playing for Sweden, of course, a Red Wing great. Matt Zuccarello, playing for Norway, fractured a hand, missed 4 weeks for the Rangers. Barkov, in his rookie year, playing for Finland, had a knee injury, was out almost a month. And then we saw last year in the Four Nations, Tkachuk's and McAvoy and Theodore and Vinny Trocheck and all these injuries. How impactful might this be? We've got NHL team. There are 8 NHL teams that have seven or more players playing in the Olympics.
Well, Mike, you bring up a great point, and there is no doubt that certain teams are going to lose huge players, and it's going to impact their ability to try and go win the Stanley Cup. I totally understand these hockey players wanting to play in the Olympics for their country. They tried to do the Four Nations, whatever they call it. You know, that's different. It's not as big of a deal to those hockey players. That's fine. You want to play in the Olympics? Go play in the Summer Olympics. Because here's what the NHL is doing. You're pretty well shut down for the month of February. You are telling the world that there's a tournament going on. It's more important than what we're doing. So, okay, if the hockey players have to go play in the Olympics, go play in the Summer Olympics.
Great point, Pat. We thank you for your time. It was such a pleasure talking to you again. My only problem is, who the heck do I get next week to top this? The great Pat Foley, everyone. Thank you, Pat, so much.
Good being with you, Mike. And good luck with Palm Saturday. It's going to be awesome.
Thanks, buddy. When we come back after the break, we'll talk about Illinois at Michigan State tonight as well as the Cubs offseason. It's Palm Saturdays on 104.3 The Score.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be, with no bet fees, on 104.3 The Score.
Welcome back into Palm Saturdays here on The Score. Terrific from Pat Foley there. Really appreciate Pat's time. We got about 10 minutes left in the program. Be sure to stay tuned for Inside the Clubhouse with David Haw and Bruce Levine following this program. Hopefully a lot of their loyal listeners have tuned in a little bit early. And everybody out there in Chicagoland is figuring out. We've got live programming on The Score from 8 to 9 on Saturdays. Duke plays North Carolina this afternoon at Chapel Hill, but in a poll of college basketball fans, the game of the day, narrowly, a narrow margin, 34% to 32%, is Illinois at Michigan State. I said 2 weeks ago I thought that Illinois was the best team in the Big Ten, and that's quite a statement. When you've got four teams in the Big Ten ranked in the top 10 in the country, I was not dissuaded from that opinion. Watching them in Lincoln, Nebraska last Sunday avenge their lone Big Ten loss to Nebraska. Nebraska had a tremendous flurry right before the half to build up a double-digit lead, and Illinois really dominated them in the second half on the road. They've now won 12 straight games. They are 11-1 in the Big Ten, 20-3 overall. They're tied with Michigan atop the conference. They're a game and a half ahead of Nebraska and two games ahead of Michigan State. And now tonight, a trip to East Lansing. I don't like the fact that Michigan State has lost two straight games. Last Friday night, they lost to Michigan, and then Wednesday, losing, being upset by Minnesota. However, there's some problems there. If you guys have been following this team, Jeremy Fears, their outstanding point guard, the last few games has had some, let's say, questionable behavior with some unnatural movements and kicking and stomping of other players. Dustin May, the Michigan coach, called it out in a press conference on Monday following Friday's game about the dirty play from Michigan State, specifically Fears. Izzo said this week that he may sit Fears until he quote, needs to grow up. However, here's the problem. The backup point guard is injured for Michigan State. So it's hard for me to believe that it's going to be this game against Illinois that he sits them. But back to the Illini and this impressive run, starting December 22nd, these 12 straight victories. During this time frame, according to Bart Torvik, who's a college basketball analyst, they are the number one team in the country in that span from December 22nd to today. Houston being number two, Duke being number three, Arizona undefeated and number one in the country, number six during that time frame. And according to Ken Palm, Illinois has the best offense in the country. Adjusted offense, they are the most efficient offense in the country. I guess the knock on this team is they don't create a lot of turnovers, but they're so good on the offensive side of the ball. Now, the line on this game surprised me a bit, and it came out yesterday at Michigan State favored by 1.5 with a total of 144.5. I made this number Illinois 1.5. And if you're talking about a three-point swing from your number to the posted number, the bettable number, that around zero is the least impactful, of course, because it can't land on zero. So you take that integer out of it. I do like Illinois in this spot. I wonder how this number is going to move today. I have not bet the game yet. If it gets to two, I absolutely will play Illinois. If the game comes back to a pick, that's fine. If Illinois gets to favoritism, I'll probably just play them on a short money line as a favorite. But keep your eye on this team. Terrific stuff going on downstate with Brad Underwood and this team, and how he's developed some of these guys that weren't thought to be All-Americans into really terrific players, especially in that front court. I want to close out. If you asked me about my fandom, I would say my two favorite sports are baseball and hockey. I like college basketball. I don't watch a ton of NBA, only enough to follow the breaking news. But a little tidbit of baseball here to close out the show and talking about the Chicago Cubs. We just at Circa started to put out all of our season win totals this week, as well as the division odds. We did have the World Series odds up a couple of weeks ago. Well, actually, after the World Series ended, but updated a couple weeks ago. So right now, the Cubs at Circa Sports are 15-1 to win the World Series, plus 765 to win the National League. They are once again the favorites to win the NL Central. Now, remember last year, they were favored as well. I bet them at even money last year, and then after they lost the two games to the Dodgers in Japan, I bet them at plus 110. They had a great first half of the season, but again, the Brewers outperformed expectations. The Cubs had a terrific year. Their win total was 86.5. They won 92 games last year and were the number one wild card. Unfortunately, the Milwaukee Brewers had the best record in the National League at 97-65. Maybe people forget that. They were the one seed, remember? And of course, they got absolutely shut down by the Dodgers in the NLCS. They scored 1, 2, 3, 4 runs in those four games, getting swept. But you know, the Cubs were the four seed, the number one wild card, and beat the Padres, but ran out of gas and really ran out of starting pitching in that series against Milwaukee. I thought Council made a big mistake trying to steal a few innings with Matt Boyd in Game 1. I don't know if that would have made any difference in the series. Let's take a look at the rest of the division odds and the season win totals. Cubs, as I said, plus 120, so a better price than last year to begin with. Brewers plus 225. This is the number that I would draw a line through. The Reds at plus 375. I really scratched my heads at some of their offseason moves and what kind of a roster they're trying to build. I can't believe Francona came back for this. So I would fade the Reds of this group. And we will, as these Saturdays go on with football being over, we'll get into some more division previews as we get closer to pitchers and catchers reporting in less than 2 weeks. Pirates plus 980. Amazing they haven't built more of a team around Paul Skeens. Just absolutely amazing they haven't done that. And the Cardinals, did you ever think the Cardinals would be 45-1 just to win the division? The Cardinals' win total is 70. 70. We're predicting the number suggests the Cardinals are going to lose 92 games. 70-92. Absolutely amazing. Cubs win total 88.5, up from 86.5 last year. Brewers are at 84.5. Reds 82.5. I'm under that. Pirates 77.5. And as I said, the Cardinals 70. Now, what did the Cubs do in the offseason? I thought the worst grade you could give the Cubs is an A-. I loved the Bregman signing, and I loved it for beyond the field reasons. I loved it because I think he's going to be much more of a clubhouse leader than Kyle Tucker ever was. Now, is it fair to say Kyle Tucker should have been a clubhouse leader? I don't know. He was your superstar, but he clearly was a reluctant leader. And we found out last summer in Chicago, why Houston was willing to part with him. Well, you can't criticize Tucker, who just signed a $240 million contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers. When I saw that come through, 4 years for $60 million a year, I had to check my phone. I thought it was a prank, just like when they said Bo Nix broke his ankle at the end of the game. I thought it was a prank, a spoof. Somebody's Twitter account had got hacked. Kyle Tucker is making $60 million a year. All that means is that you can bet 100% certainty that there's going to be a lockout after this season. The small market owners can't tolerate this nonsense. And the problem with Major League Baseball is that they gave this deal because of the McCourt bankruptcy to the Los Angeles Dodgers, that they wouldn't have to share their TV revenue for 25 years. Well, we're halfway through it, and what have you done here? Absolutely incredible. Love Bregman. You needed pop in that lineup. Loved Cabrera from Miami. I thought a contender would have picked up Edward Cabrera last year. He is a top-flight young right-handed pitcher. Great signing. Imanaga, another one-year deal. Maton, they lost most of their bullpen. They picked up four pieces, Maton being the best of that. Now the starting staff, Steele's coming off an elbow surgery. That's a question mark. Can Matt Boyd and Jameson Taillon stay healthy the whole year? And Palencia, a little bit of the bloom was off the rose as the closer. From the offensive side of the ball, can PCA, Michael Bush, Nico Horner, and Carson Kelly come back to those career years that they had? Well, that's a big question mark. But I think it's going to be a very, very interesting season. How would you feel if you're a Detroit Tiger? You go to arbitration with two-time Cy Younger Skubal and give him $32 million, but you sign Framber Valdez for 3 years for $38. Isn't life grand? Thanks for being with us for the very first edition of Palm Saturdays. Looking forward to coming to you every single Saturday for the rest of the year, 8 a.m. Now, stay tuned on 104.3 The Score. It's Inside the Clubhouse with David Haw and Bruce Levine.